So tonight we look at the events and trends of the 17th century as we continue our journey through 2,000 years of the Jewish Odyssey. The 17th century would be a tumultuous one with events that would not only shape us until today, but also dramatically affect the development of the Jewish community in the two centuries immediately thereafter. So in that sense, it's critical to understand the events and trends of this century, especially as we begin to glimpse all the problems of modern life, but in their incipient stages. The decisive intellectual and spiritual event of the 16th century, as we discussed, was the publication of the Shulchan Aruch, that in short order was accepted as definitive by the Jewish people, or as definitive as we can ever be about anything. Soon after, the Krakow edition was published in 1570. Keep in mind, both the Ramah and Rabbi Yosef Karo were alive, and the Krakow edition was the one that included the Ramah's Mapa. Others began writing their own commentaries on that work. Last time we discussed the Levush and the Sma. These commentaries would proliferate in the 17th century as the Shulchan Aruch took the form that it's in today, with only very minor additions. You take our Shulchan Aruch off the shelf in the Beis Medrash, and basically you see what was added to it in the 17th century. The first generally known the Shulchan Aruch itself, but on the tour, was the work of Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, 1561 to 1640, known to all as the Bach, the Bayis Chadosh, that he wrote on the Tur and the Beis Yosef. It was a commentary, an analysis, a critique, in which he offered his own opinions as well when he disagreed with the Beis Yosef. Some of the leniencies of the Bach are relied on until today. Most famously, who wants to hear a leniency of the Bach we rely on? A big audience of that. Chadosh, correct. The Bach held that Chadosh can be eaten in the exile, as the prohibition does not apply to non-Jewish grain, against the Ramah, against many authorities, but that was the opinion of the Bach, and to a great extent we've relied on that Bach until today. The Bach had a very dominant mind and a very strong personality as well. He was born and raised in Poland. He took his first rabbinical position in Prusian, of all places, and then because of his strong personality, he bounced from place to place until settling in Krakow. He also did something that had a very modern tinge to it. He was the first gadol to check Talmudic manuscripts in order to ascertain the precise text. All his emendations were recorded in the Vilna Shas on the page under the heading Hagos HaBach, without which it's really difficult to learn the Gemara. But I should mention, you all know, but I recovered, I should mention that we're sponsored as always by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ilin Ishmas Yonah Ben Rabariyaleh, Tein Ishmas Otsur Vatsarachayim. Now the Bach's son-in-law and Talmud was the Taz, Reb David Alevi, 1586 to 1667, lived a relatively long life. And the Taz, like all these people, were named after his work on the Shulchan Aruch, the Turei Zov. He often quotes his father-in-law in his parish, Mori Chami Zal, my teacher, my father-in-law Zal. The Taz lived in great poverty until he founded his yeshiva in Ostro, but he personally experienced in his long life many of the tribulations of this century to which we will return. Now his famous Bar Plukta, his famous disputant, was the Shach, Reb Shapsi HaKohen, 1622 to 1663, with a short life, 41 years. They never met, even though their lives crossed. So they never directly addressed each other in their original commentaries. Now think about it, both the Shach and the Taz were being written at the same time, and really all things considered not that far from each other, but neither really knew of the other's existence. The Shach wrote his own commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, and it was published. The Taz was published. And when the Shach learned of the Taz, the Shach wrote a critique on the Taz called the Nekudas HaKesef. Get the pun. The Taz is the Turei Zov, columns of gold. So he wrote the points of silver on the columns of gold. Put a lot of thought into it, I'm sure. That work was later challenged by the Taz's grandson in a work called Meginei Zahav, Defenders of the Gold. Get it? To resolve defenders of the goal. Now, they didn't write on the entire Shulchan Aruch. The Shach, as I mentioned, did not live a long life. But where they did, the Shach and the Taz are most widely known for Yoredeus. Anyone who studies the Smicha, you can't live, can't breathe without the Shach and the Taz on Yoredeus. A contemporary of theirs was the Magen Avraham, Rav Avraham Gombiner from the town of Gombin, also 1634 to 1682, a short life, 48 years. He became the Dayan in Kalish after the Shach passing through gave a shir, posed the question that only the young Magen Avraham was able to answer. Then they spoke in learning. The Shach saw he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, and then everyone else in Kalish realized his own greatness. At one point, a Krakow Dayan published his own Perish on Archaim that was called the Olas Tomid and Olas Shabbos. It was first published and became popular, but when the Magen Avraham critiqued it, it was then superseded in popularity by the Magen Avraham, and the Magen Avraham subsequently was published in all our editions of the Shulchan Aruch. Think about it. There were many, many Perushim that were written. The ones that made their way into our world on a in a prominent way, so not only are they defined by their greatness, but a bit by their mazel as well. Add to them the Cheltas Mechokek on Eben Ezer and the Beis Shmuel, and by the end of the 17th century, we have almost the entire Shulchan Aruch accounted for, with all subsequent commentaries, essentially commentaries on these commentaries, and that became the book that Jews studied. Why? We'll get back to as well. It's an interesting development in Jewish life generally. In the late 16th century, Polish Jewry formed a council, a self-governing council, called the Wad Arba Arzas, the Council of the Four Lands, consisting of rabbis and communal leaders who would meet twice annually for extended periods of time, about a month each, in early spring and late summer, coinciding with the big trade fairs in Lublin and in Yaroslav. Now the Arba Arzas, these four lands, were what we call Little Poland in the Krakow area, Greater Poland to the west in Silesia, Polish Russia to the east, and Volhynia near Kremenitz. And that became the official representative body of Polish Jewry, recognized by non-Jewish authorities, and was one of the few times in Christian Europe when Jews enjoyed self-government. In fact, you'd have to go back probably to the time of the Talmud in Bavel to find where Jews had such an extended period of self-government. In the 17th century, the Wad Arba Arzas was in its prime. It settled disputes, it enacted decrees, it issued charamim, excommunications when necessary and appropriate, it could tax the community for communal needs. All told, the council always functioned with 70 delegates, like a Sanhedrin. It was a quasi-court and quasi-legislature as well. And much of Polish Jewry, of Jewish history of this era, can be deduced from the Pinkus, from the record that was kept of these sessions for almost two centuries, until the Wad Arba Arzas was disbanded by the Polish authorities in 1764. Now, in the 16th and 17th centuries, Jews expanded across the globe, as did mankind generally, through the widespread explorations that took place. The land of Israel fell on hard times in the 17th century, after the brief glories of the 16th century. Tzfat declined after the death of Yosef Karo, within a few decades after his death. Yerushalayim briefly regained its primacy, but then the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire decided to almost relinquish direct control over the land of Israel. He appointed local governors, and no longer under the Sultan's protection, and left to the vicissitudes of the local governors, who often ruthless, that community Yerushalayim was regularly attacked and plundered and soon declined. So by the middle of the 17th century, the land of Israel was again bereft largely of its children, who had turned their eyes elsewhere. One place to which Jews turned their eyes was England. Recall that England expelled its Jews in 1290 But in the 16th century, there's a small trickle that began to return, keeping a very low profile. Not secret, but a low profile. They were mainly Sephardi merchants who came to do business and therefore were welcomed as long as they didn't identify publicly as Jews. But the tide turned in the mid-17th century when the Puritans began to assert control over English life, and the controversial Oliver Cromwell became the Lord Protector of England, the military and political leader in the 1650s. Cromwell was moved by both practical and spiritual concerns, and he allowed the Jews to formally and openly return in 1656, even allowing them to become citizens. Practically, because trade with the Jewish merchants and businessmen in Amsterdam was crucial to England's well-being, and spiritually, because Cromwell subscribed to a Christian belief held by the Puritans that the Second Coming would not occur until all the Jews had converted. That idea is still around today, by the way. And therefore, England can do its share by having Jews live among them and attempting to convert them. Whatever the theory, Jews came to live in Britain, and after Charles II became king again in 1660, Jews were officially and openly welcomed, and from that time until recently, the community grew into prominence. As we know, the Puritans set their sights on the Americas as well, and so did the Jews at a very early age. The first Jews to come to this continent, to come to the Western Hemisphere, were mainly conversos, and given the viciousness of the hatred, it's no surprise that the Inquisition followed them here, wherever Jews settled in the 17th century, to Peru, to Cuba, to Mexico. Jews were even slaughtered in these places when they were unmasked as conversos. Wherever Spain had dominion, Jews suffered. But these Jews, therefore, always had to remain one step ahead of the authorities, and Jews found haven in the Dutch lands, the Dutch-controlled territories, especially in Curaçao, where in 1651 they built a shul called Mikve Yisrael, and this remains the oldest shul still existing continuously in the Western Hemisphere. The shul has a sand floor, again from its very origin, symbolizing to some the Jews wandering in the wilderness and the impermanence of exile. It's a nice shul to visit. The current building dates back to 1732, coincidentally the year of George Washington's birth. In 1651, Jews first came to New York, where we were not especially welcomed. Irony of ironies. Peter Stuyvesant, old peg leg, the director general of the new settlement, despised Jews and tried to bar us from his settlement. He also hated Quakers as well. A very narrow view of what he wanted New Amsterdam to be. Didn't quite work out. Now, the first Jews who came, 24 in all, were refugees from Recife, Brazil. Recife was a Dutch colony that was conquered by the Portuguese. Once the Portuguese came, Jews naturally feared again for the Inquisition, for their lives, and so they sailed north to New Amsterdam. When they got there, they found out that Peter Stuyvesant wasn't much better. Stuyvesant barred Jews from serving in the militia, and then he taxed them heavily for not serving. Neat, neat trick. Stuyvesant barred Jews from building a shul, from practicing mitzvahs openly. He petitioned his superiors back in Amsterdam, I quote, that the deceitful race, such hateful enemies and blasphemers of the name of Christ, not be allowed further to infect and trouble this new colony. That was Stuyvesant's request. That Russia's name is still all over New York, by the way. There was a man whose name is found in a few locations in New York City as well today, named Usher Levy, Zachur Latov, who was a wealthy merchant, and because of his wealth, he not only challenged Stuyvesant, but he was able to appeal to the authorities in the Netherlands as well. Usher Levy won the right for Jews to serve in the militia and have freedom of worship, any event, New Amsterdam was conquered by the British in 1664, ending the Dutch reign. If in Lower Manhattan, think around East 23rd Street, right off the FDR Drive, there's such a street called Usher Levy Place. Now you'll know what it's all about. In 1677, a Jewish community came into being in Newport, Rhode Island, even though the Torah synagogue there was not built until 1759, about less than 100 years later. The settlement of the New World, though, was almost exclusively Sephardi, and did little to help the Jews avert the devastating event of the 17th century that would unleash shockwaves that still reverberate and that had its genesis in Ukraine. All the so-called progressive movements had impacted on Western Europe, Italy, Germany, France, etc., the Renaissance, Reformation. Eastern Europe was left untouched and unaffected in its natural state of brutality and barbarity that the Jews would soon find. Bogdan Chmelnytsky appeared on the scene in the 1630s with grievances against the Polish nobility that ignited a wider war that eventually consumed the good part of Klal Yisrael. So his early wars in the 1630s to liberate Ukraine did not affect Jews at all. In the end it did. Poland and Russia had both wealthy and poor Jews. And that's what we should realize. That's the way it always was. Just like there were Jews who were destitute, but really destitute, the Jews were very successful as well. The problem was, well, problem of course is used a bit sardonically, but the problem vis-a-vis the rest of the world was that even the poor Jews were educated and lived with a sense of dignity that distinguished them from the peasants. Jews were almost never among the drunkards, never among the lower elements of the society, and that alone made the peasants envious. Added to that was the fact that the Polish landowners exacted high taxes and rents from the peasants in Poland, Russia, Ukraine, and those landowners usually used Jews as their rent collectors, their real estate managers. Then is now a Jewish profession. So when the war really erupted in fury in the late 1640s, Jews were natural targets, even though they were not directly involved in the conflict. Chmelnytsky went to war with his Ukrainian Cossacks, ostensibly to liberate Ukraine from the Poles, but the war took place against the backdrop of a larger conflict that also added to the discontent, even hostility towards Jews. This war began in 1648. The 30 years war ended in 1648. That was a deadly war, an outgrowth of the Counter-Reformation, Catholics against Protestants, a war that was fought mainly in Germany that really halved, more than halved, the German population. Germany was ravaged during that fighting. One early victor, only sounds strange today, was Sweden. Sweden was a world power in the 17th century that expanded its holdings until it became the third largest empire in Europe. It's a short-lived empire. The Swedes could not conquer Prague, and the flag of Prague Jewry, which is a yellow hat inside a Magen David, was given to the Jews of Prague as a gift by the King of Prague for the Jews' participation in the defense of Prague against the Swedish invasion in the 1640s. That flag still hangs from the ceiling of the Altneuschul. More than that, though, the Jews profited during the 30 Years' War. So again, it's one of the few wars in Europe during this entire millennium. It was Jews did not suffer. It was the opposite. Jews became involved in the supply of arms and food to the troops. So when the 30 Years' War ended, it ended with the Peace of Westphalia, itself significant in world history. It's the first real international conference in history that established the laws of states with borders and sovereignty and recognition, etc. None of this would help the Jews, who would suffer from their newly won status and prosperity as a result of the 30 Years' War. Chmelnytsky began his wars rallying the Russian Orthodox, or Ukrainian Orthodox Cossacks against the Catholic Poles, avenging a series of insults and worse. He liberated Ukraine, he conquered a good part of Poland and Lithuania, and then he allowed his men, or he and his men, poured out their wrath against the Jews, what became known as Gzeirot Tachvetat, the decrees of 408 and 409, 1648 and 1649. The Polish nobility in Ukraine and the surrounding areas were eradicated. An estimated 100,000 Jews were killed, but it might be a slight exaggeration. More safer to say about 10% of the Jewish population were murdered. Hundreds of Jewish communities were wiped out with shocking brutality that unfortunately presaged the Nazis. Jews in Nemirov and Lvov and Brisk and many other places were murdered in cold blood. But cold blood. Jews had their hands and limbs chopped off while they were alive, thrown to wild dogs. Pregnant women were sliced open. Infants were roasted alive and fed to their parents. All of this recorded in a sefer called Yivei Metzulah, a chronicle of Rav Nosson Nota Hanover, the disciple of the Marshal, who was an eyewitness and wrote a contemporaneous account. Chmielnitsky himself is still reviled in Poland for his excesses, but as often happens to Jews, he remains a hero in Ukraine, where a statue of him on horseback, rising upward, sullies the square in front of St. Sophie's Cathedral in Kiev. At one point during the massacres, Jews were offered a chance to convert and save themselves. But harking back to the Crusades and not to Jewish Spain, very, very few did. Almost none recorded. They allowed themselves to die al kiddush Hashem. The Shah became a refugee and wrote Megillat Eifah, depicting the cruelty. He wrote a kinah for Chof Sivan. Chof Sivan, 1648, is when the 6,000 Jews of Nemirov were killed in one day. The Taz had to flee from place to place. A young Mungin Avram, who was only 14 years old, saw his parents murdered in front of his eyes. Financial support for the Jews of Yerushalayim, nothing really changes, dried up because of the ravages of Europe, speeding that community's deterioration. So you see the snowball effect of what happened. Jews also fought back where they could. Remember, they'd been in the arms business slightly to the west, fought often bravely, but ineffectively. One great Rav, the Tosfos Yom Tov, Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, who had been the Rav in Bohemia and Prague and Krakow and elsewhere, worked tirelessly after the massacres to free Agunos and to rebuild Jewish life. It was then that Tosfos Yom Tov wrote his famous Mishaberach, "For those people who don't talk in shul," as he attributed the disaster partly to that terrible but apparently enduring sin. Of course, the Tosfos Yom Tov is best known for the Perush on the Mishnah that he wrote soon after. Chmielnitsky liberated the Ukraine, or they call themselves Ukraine today, but never fully conquered Poland, and he was stopped, actually, in 1651. He reached out to the Tsar for help. Then he reached out to the Swedes, who were controlling Poland, but by 1657, Chmielnitsky was dead. By that time, Jews had begun to rebuild in Poland, but then and thereafter, always wary of what sudden outbursts of hatred might bring. Bear in mind, it wasn't a complete shock. Polish Catholic Jew hatred with persistent blood libels, but persistent meaning regularly, every couple of years, had become common already in the 16th century and didn't end until after the Holocaust. But Poland's regression as a nation, it was prosperous in the 16th century, its regression, the loss of its economic stability, went hand in hand with its mistreatment of Polish Jews until it became a backward country. In fact, in the late 18th century, it really lost its independence altogether. Also, interestingly, after these horrific events, that's when all the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch were written. As Jews sought certainty in the world of halacha where they could not find it in the world outside. So in two decades, you found the Shach and the Taz and Magen Avraham and the Beis Shmuel, the Chalkas Mechokek. They're all written and published right afterwards. But even a more sinister consequence was straight ahead. as the Kabbalists, bless them, had predicted that 1648 was potentially a messianic year and had therefore aroused Jewish interest in the redemption. So the massacres left the Jews deflated and looking for salvation in, of course, the wrong places. Shabtai Tzvi, 1626 to 1676, took advantage of all this. He was born ostensibly, he claimed to be born on Tisha B'Av, the day that traditionally Mashiach is born, born in Smyrna, today Izmir in western Turkey. He was yeshiva trained, the Talmud of Rabbi Yosef Eskapa, one of the great Rabbanim in Turkey. He's held to be a genius, knowledgeable in Torah, Kabbalah, a beautiful singing voice, very popular, a little strange too. Already in his youth, people saw that he committed what they wrote as masim zarim, strange acts. He was very weird, but charismatic. Today we'd probably say he was mentally ill, a manic, depressive, psychotic, with highs and lows, and therefore when he was high, he was able to attract a lot of attention. In his early 20s, he started pronouncing the Shem Hashem, Yudke Vavke, in full. He became an ascetic. He self-flagellated. He isolated himself. He went to the mikveh numerous times during the day. The two opinions developed about him, either he was a tzaddik or he was nuts. I guess sometimes he'd be both. But that was one of the two. He was married and divorced before the age of 22. At that age, he dreamt he was Mashiach, told it to his family, and they told him to cool it. He claimed miraculous salvations from drownings and lions and wolves. 3 years later, at the age of 25, he went public in Smyrna with Mashiach talk. He was put in Cherem, he was given Malkos, he was expelled, and all that confirmed for him that he was Mashiach, because Mashiach would be rejected by the people. He wandered for 7 years through Turkey and Greece, didn't make any claims, became very popular. He was a strange figure that attracted a following. In Salonika, among the weird deeds, he publicly married a Sefer Torah under the chuppah. People came too. And he was driven out from many places that he visited. Finally, in 1658, back in Smyrna, he revealed himself, proclaimed himself Mashiach with a new religion. He took an updated version of Yadus. He took the liberty of violating halacha publicly, even making a bracha before Matir Isurim. Get it? We said bracha in the morning of Matir Asurim. God frees the incarcerated, the bound. Turns to Matir Isurim. So he gets a nice bracha to say when he's about to commit an isur. In Constantinople, once he celebrated all three regalim in 1 week. Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. Chometz, Matzah, Matan Torah, Lulav, Esther, Sukkah. It's like the old joke about the astronaut, you know, going around the earth. Shachas, Mincha, Maariv, Shachas, Mincha, Maariv. That's what he did in 1 week. And he felt himself possessed. He sought Kabbalistic means to free himself from torment, sailed to Rhodes and to Cairo, then to Gaza, where in 1663 he met Nosson of Gaza, Nathan of Gaza, who's a Kabbalist, a Talmud of Yaakov Chagiz, one of the Gedolim of the age, and solicited the help of Nosson of Gaza to cure his tortured soul. Nosson told him that there's no cure because he thought that Shabtai Tzvi was the Mashiach, and Nosson was his prophet and public relations agent. Shavuot 1665 in Gaza, Nosson in a trance reveals to his students that Shabtai Tzvi is the Mashiach and he's the Navi. That convinces Shabtai Tzvi himself. He calls for mass tshuva, sweeps all of Gaza Jewry, including Yaakov Nadjara, the grandson of Yisrael Nadjara, wrote the Karibon. Shabtai Tzvi then rides around the land of Israel on horseback, and the word spreads, and it spreads. The summer of 65, he rides into Jerusalem with an entourage. Masses gather around him. Rabbanim are powerless to stop him. Some even supported him. A cult of personality arises. Every question people have about him, his behavior, his weirdness, his public sins, they're all explained away, and this sets a pattern. The world reacts. The news throughout the Jewish world spreads like wildfire, or what passed for wildfire in those days, except for pockets of skepticism. Nelson of Gaza publishes a letter that Jews have to change the liturgy to accommodate the new reality, and he says whoever doubts him, Shabtai Tzvi will punish him. That year they abolish Shavasa B'Tammuz, they abolish Tisha B'Av. He said Shabtai Tzvi will be able to subjugate the Sultan without war at all. The news then travels, Greece, Turkey, Egypt, Italy. Wild reports circulate of miracles, of the 10 tribes reappearing, that Jews have conquered Mecca, all fueled by the frenzy and by the slow communication of the times. Jews across Europe start selling their property, preparing to go to Israel. Then it spreads to Western Europe, to Amsterdam, to Hamburg, to Frankfurt. Wealthy Jews start renting ships to carry them to Israel, and worse, they start threatening revenge on the non-Jews that have been tormenting them for centuries. 1665, the news sweeps Russia and Poland. Shabtai Tzvi proclaims himself Emperor of the Jews, goes back to Turkey, to Smyrna, then Constantinople. He sets up court, and the Sultan in Adrianople looks away, as Shabtai Tzvi then did not challenge his authority publicly. The Taz even sent his son and son-in-law to visit, and they returned with gifts, and the Taz did not oppose him. He had opponents. The early Rabbonim who knew him in Turkey opposed him. Yosef Eskapa was already dead. One of his prominent opponents was Yaakov Sasportas in Amsterdam. And when he opposed him publicly, wrote against him, they kicked him out in Amsterdam. They didn't want to hear from Yaakov Sasportas. The people were overwhelmed. In late 1665, Shabtai Tzvi is again acting bizarrely in Smyrna. Rabbonim tried to stop him, and they couldn't. He was just too popular. In the fall of 1665, again, he said that Shavasa B'Tammuz, Tisha B'Av, not permanently abolished. That year they were observed as festivals in Turkey. He then acted lewd in public at a public orgy. He ate treif, always reciting the bracha Matir Isurim, always be careful to say brachos, pronouncing the shame, announcing the Geula will come the 15th of Sivan, June 18th, 1666. On Hanukkah, he flipped out completely. He broke down the door to the Portuguese shul with an axe. He read the Torah from a chumash. He called men and women for aliyos. He pronounced Hashem Hashem again. He denounced the Rabbanim. Rav Chaim ben Venisti supported him. Rav Aaron LaPapa did not and had to go into hiding. Rav Shomal Ghazi, another gadol in Turkey, had to flee Smyrna. In Teves, they dropped the prayer for the Sultan. They said a public tefillah for Shabtai Tzvi, referred to as Amir, Adonenu Malkenu Yarum Hodo, our Lord, our King, His Majesty exalted. I think I feel like that today also, by the way. Excitement abounds. In the end, he proclaimed that he will liberate Yerushalayim from the Sultan, and that was a big mistake. Sultan Mehmet IV had Shabtai Tzvi arrested in Constantinople, but first he brought him to Gallipoli, treated him well, let him set up his own court there, and Shabtai Tzvi perceived his arrest as Chevel Mashiach as all part of the plan. In prison, he slaughtered a carbon Pesach, an Erev Pesach, and ate it. He signed a letter, "Your God, Shabtai Tzvi." Brought to the palace in Adrianople, a renegade Jew denounced him as a traitor to the Sultan. Shabtai Tzvi was then given a choice of apostasy or death. September 15th, 1666, he converts to Islam. The Sultan hopes many Jews will follow. He renounces his messianic pretensions. He takes the name Aziz Mehmed Effendi. He accepts money to become an officer in the royal court, and the people are shocked. There are two types of shock. Shock at being deluded, and the greater shock that his messianic claims do not end. His followers, then diehard followers, create a theory that it's all part of the plan, his conversion. It's the final tikkun to lift the holy sparks found in Islam back to Torah. He's like a spy in the enemy camp, so don't think just because he converted to Islam that he's not the Mashiach. Nonetheless, most Jews then are depressed and disheartened. By 1670, most had lost faith in him when they saw conversion wasn't temporary. Shabtai Tzvi actually lived out his life as a Muslim in Adrianople. Many followers did convert with him. He was arrested again in 1672, sent to Albania, where he died 4 years later. Nathan of Gaza then saying he did not die, but he ascended to the Or HaElyon, to the supernal light, also eerily reminiscent of our day. Long term, Jews became weary of new movements. Every new movement somehow had to withstand the accusation that it was Sabbatean. Hasidus, Haskalah, Zionism, others as well. And then a new threat appeared on the horizon that would also henceforth shape Jewish life. The Jews of Amsterdam came to prominence in the 17th century. In the late 16th century, after Holland declared its independence from Spain, Sephardim emigrated in large numbers from Spain and Portugal, especially conversos, and they began the famous Spanish-Portuguese community there. They were prominent merchants and traders with substantial investments in the famous Dutch East India Company. We learned about it in grade school and social studies, that would control much of the New World. The Dutch East India Company was about a quarter owned by Jews. And they would also begin the Jewish diamond business there in Western Europe that flourishes until today. With religious and economic freedom, unfortunately, came a corrosion of their Torah study and their Shmiras HaMitzvos in an atmosphere that today, I guess, could be loosely described as modern orthodoxy. In that sense, they observed the mitzvos as much as they could, but they're really integrated into the secular world. Born into that milieu was Baruch Spinoza. 1632 to 1677, the son of Portuguese Jews, educated in a Chaim Yeshiva in Amsterdam, whose life took a sad twist. He's a very bright person, genius. There was no Yeshiva Gedola in Amsterdam. They did not see it as part of their requirements, prerequisites of Jewish life. It's enough to go through, say, high school and then go out to university or to work. So formal Torah study ended relatively young. Spinoza was brilliant. He was also very frail and ascetic, barely ate. So he was not at all a mumer l'tayavon. What drove him off the derech is not entirely clear. He did find himself in the company of philosophers and thinkers, Jews and non-Jews, and he did have an inquisitive, searching mind. He was still observant. When his father died in 1654, he said Kaddish for him, all these things in the records of the community, and then he plummeted. In early 1656, Spinoza began writing and spreading his views in the Amsterdam Jewish community, including the yeshiva he attended, all in the current of the times, adopting what we would call today a pantheist view of the world, that, so to speak, God is nature and nature is God, perhaps meaning, but without quite saying, that there is only nature and there is no God. He denied Torah ben Hashemayim, Nevuah, even the very notion of Hashgacha Pratis, that God is involved in the world and the affairs of man and dictates how man should live and the best way for man to live. Spinoza adopted a purely rationalistic approach to life and to metaphysics. The simpletons in ivory towers trace his intellectual journey to the Rambam, which is a distortion of the Rambam. But the truth is, Baruch Spinoza denied each of the 13 principles, and he rejected mitzvahs also. So as such, what Spinoza did was deny the legitimacy of all revealed religions. And that made him anathema to Christians as much as to Jews. When he was confronted by the rabbana of the community, immediately they argued and pleaded with him for 6 months, and then took a drastic move on July 26, 1656. For Dutch Jewry, it was deja vu. 30 years earlier, they confronted a similar situation. A Jew named Uriel da Costa, a descendant of conversos, wasn't as well educated as Spinoza, but had similarly begun propagating corrupt notions of God and Torah Shabbat Peh. He held a Chazal distorted the Torah. He was excommunicated by the Amsterdam Basin in 1616, And it had an effect. He recanted. But he relapsed, denying Hasharas HaNefesh, the immortality of the soul, and he was again put in Cheirem in 1624, and that was a much harsher experience the second time around, to which he submitted. Uriel da Costa was forced to confess his sins before a packed shul, and then to lie down at the shul's entrance, where each member got a chance to step on him and spit on the way out. Da Costa did not enjoy this as much as they thought he would. He went home and he killed himself. That was not going to happen to Spinoza. On July 27, 1656, the Amsterdam Basin pronounced the Cheirem against Baruch Spinoza that said, in pertinent part, and all these in the records of the community, having long known of evil opinions and acts of Baruch the Spinoza, the Basin has long endeavored by various means and promises to turn him from evil ways, not being able to find any remedy, but on the contrary receiving every day more information about the abominable heresies practiced and taught by him and monstrous acts committed by him, having as for many trustworthy witnesses in the presence of the said Spinoza, the council decided with the advice of the rabbis that the said Spinoza should be excommunicated and cut off from the nation of Israel. We anathematize, execrate, curse, and cast out Baruch the Spinoza, pronouncing against him the Cheirem of Yeshua against Jericho, the curse with which Elisha cursed the children, and all the maledictions written in the Torah. He should be accursed. Yomo v'layla, b'shachbo v'kumo, b'tzeiso u'bivolo. May God never acknowledge him or pardon him. May the wrath and displeasure of God burn against this man henceforth and raise out his name from under the sky. And then they got tough. And they said, no one can be under the same roof as him. No one can be dala amos of him, a full cheirem. Spinoza didn't take the cheirem lying down. He moved to The Hague, calling himself then Benedictus, Baruch, where he was offered a professorship at the University in The Hague, that he spurned, and he eked out a living as an optician, as a lens grinder. He was cut off from his family's money, lived a pauper's existence. In 1670, he published unsigned his work called Theological Political Tractate that outlined these and other heretical views, including a comprehensive attack on the authorship of Tanakh. Spinoza died, apparently of tuberculosis, shortly thereafter, age 45, alienated from his family and his nation, and basically unknown. He became more widely known after his death. His book was not allowed to be published because of Christian objections to it, so his real fame dates to the 19th century and the Enlightenment. The statue of him, Spinoza, still stands before his last home in The Hague. He had a number of legacies with which we grapple until today. Spinoza became the father of modern biblical criticism. He gave respectable entree to the Jewish world of the 19th century German notion that the Tanakh, Rachmanus Lan, is not divine, that the Torah is an amalgam of different documents of a variety of authors, poorly edited over the course of many centuries, which is biblical criticism in a nutshell. Without God, there is no binding Torah. So Spinoza became what's known today as the first secular Jew, the patron saint of, so to speak, of all Jews who reject God, who perceive the Torah as human, and the Torah's values as humanist, and do not consider themselves bound by mitzvahs. In that sense, Spinoza is a hero to Reform Judaism. Naturally, in 1962, Ben-Gurion petitioned to have the Cheirem on Spinoza lifted. He failed. Thirdly, Spinoza was what we could call today a liberal rationalist. Since he denied revelation, he believed that man was the primary source of ethics, and that man could resolve any conflict and achieve human perfection through reason and logic. He was a natural for the Enlightenment, two centuries later. He denied God was a distinct entity or being, and therefore is in the vanguard of those who subscribe to moral relativism that again still afflicts us today. In that sense, Spinoza does live on. There were many, many, many great Rabbonim in the 17th century. I'll just mention a few. Amsterdam Jews in their heyday were led by Rabbi Menashe ben Yisrael, fascinating figure with whom we can relate. He's originally a converso from Portugal. Well, not that we are, but lived 1604 to 1657. He became their Rav at age 18. He spoke 10 languages, had a secular education, astronomy, medicine. He was well regarded by non-Jews. He wrote a book called Mikveh Yisrael, in which he claimed that the Indians in North America were part of the 10 lost tribes, and that Jews had to settle all over the world to prepare the way for Mashiach. It was Menashe ben Yisrael's work that attracted the attention of Oliver Cromwell. And Menashe ben Yisrael, in fact, sailed to Britain, to England, to appeal to Cromwell to allow the Jews to come back for Christian purposes. Just like he felt Mashiach could come when Jews would be all over the globe, Cromwell felt the same thing in his own way. He himself planned to sail to the New World. He didn't, but to a great extent he became the posek, the first posek for the Americas. It's another exotic Jew, Rabbi Yosef Shlomo Del Medigo, Yashar Mikandia. Yosef Shlomo Del Medigo, 1591 to 1655, known as the Yashar Mikandia, born on the island of Crete. It's a tremendous Talmud Chacham, had an amazingly complete secular education, studied in Padua under Galileo, went from place to place in Europe to the finest universities to study under the greatest professors. He amassed one of the largest libraries that existed at the time, traveled the world as a physician, as a Talmud Chacham, as a Rav, debating non-Jews, teaching Torah to Jews. He became a Rav in communities from Vilna to Amsterdam to Italy to the Mediterranean islands, all over the place, including the Rav of the Amsterdam Sephardim in 1628. I must make mention of Rabbi Yeshua Heschel of Krakow, who died in 1663, the Rebbe of the Shach, and the Rosh Yeshiva of the great Yeshiva in Lublin, the Naram Shif, people know from learning the Gemara, 1608 to 1644, another short life, wrote a famous commentary in the Talmud, the Naram Shif. I can give a long list of other giants, but will suffice with one other, maybe two. The Shalah HaKodesh, Rabbi Yeshaya Halevi Horowitz, 1560 to 1630, the Rav in Frankfurt, and then in Prague, at the same time as Ephraim Lunshitz, the author of the Kli Yakar. The Shalah lived there until he made Aliyah after his wife died in 1621. In fact, the Shalah HaKodesh finished his Sefer in Israel. His Sefer is a book of halacha and kabbalah and hashkafa that was written as an ethical will to his children, multi-volume ethical will, through commentaries on the Torah, the Yom Tov, etc. He, in fact, is buried in Tveria, the same place where the Rambam is buried. Other developments, briefly, in the 17th century that are just fascinating because we live with it until today. It was in the 17th century that Yiddish became the dominant language of the Jewish people, and it would retain that status until after the Holocaust, with differences in dialects, certainly differences in pronunciations, in northern Poland, Lithuania, and southern Poland, Hungary, that also exists today, with the Shayna Maidl in northern Poland, Lithuania, is a Shayna Maidl in southern Poland and Galicia and Hungary. And for the very first time, family names, surnames, became common among East European Jews, often but not always at the behest of non-Jewish authorities. In the 17th century, the Jews gave themselves names based on occupations like Becker, a baker, Schneider, a tailor, goldsmith, very frequently places of origin like my own name, my wife's name, names ending in Berg, which is a hill or a mountain, descriptions, Weiss, Schwarz, Gross, Klein, white, black, big, small, the simplest names you could find. Other names reflected Jewish interests, Kohanim, or cats, Kohanei Tzedek, or Kohn, in the Sephardic world more than the Ashkenazic world, the Azulai, abbreviation for Yishar Zanon Achaloli, Lo Yikafel, specific mitzvah to Kohanim. Levium took the name Levi, or Levine, or Siegel, Sagan Leviya. Others reflected Jewish interests, Zatz, like Rabbi Zatz, Zayin Tzedakos, the seven charities that bind a Jew, or Shatz, a Shliach Tzibur, or Shechter, obviously an occupation. And at the end of the century, for the first time, the Ashkenazic population seems to have exceeded the Sephardic population in the world, after which the Ashkenazic population continued to grow and the Sephardim not as much. It was a century of considerable achievements that really heralded the modern world, marred, of course, by the incredible butchery of Bogdan Chmelnitsky, the false hopes raised by Shabtai Tzvi, the heresies of Benedict Spinoza, all of which would resonate and repeat in centuries to come. But it was also in the 17th century that the Shulchan Aruch became the authority in the Jewish world, which returned to England and for the first time expanded to the Americas. A modern orthodoxy of sorts grew in Amsterdam with all the challenges to faith and possibilities that were advanced by the giants of the time like Newton and Galileo. And as Jews extended throughout the world, the harsh consequences of any one place of persecution were somewhat ameliorated. I say somewhat ameliorated, but that would become even more pressing as the hostility grew and new movements arose to give Jews hope, purpose, and especially in the 18th century, something to fight about for 100 years. I thank you all very much. So we resume in 2 weeks.